Welcome to the Interracial Drama Podcast. I'm your host at Leslie Mack, and I'm joined as always
by a very white guy.
And you are very, very white indeed. How are you?
You know how white I am? I hit a parked car on my trip this week, and they didn't even bother. Like, I gave them my number and everything, and they didn't call.
They didn't even call. I literally
said they might. They might. They might. But I don't know. We're going on 48 hours.
You were like, "Oh, I'm so mad." I'm like, you said you were nervous having to talk to the guy, and I said, "What are you nervous about? You're the white guy in this situation. What do you care? It's either another white guy that's gonna be like, all right, dude, or it's a non-white guy that's totally not gonna do anything to you because you're a white dude."
And well, it was really minor, privilege. Really, really minor, and you know, scratched a little bit on a bumper, not a big deal, but it's those new fancy like color coordinated bumpers, so it's scratched, you know, like the plastic just is like,
yeah, I'm aware, it's my car, so I'm aware.
No, I'm saying like
scratchness.
Old school bumpers, you could kind of like do that
buff
shit
out or whatever.
Not buff out, it just was a big rubber bumper, you could like boink and you'd be like, no big deal, like, oh, I hit a car, let me back out. Now it's like painted to the same color and it's plastic and you breathe on it and it's like, oh fuck, it's ruined.
Oh goodness. If this is your first time joining us, you can find our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search interracialjohn.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or Tumblr. Just search at interracialjohn. That's JAWN. And everything interracial john can also be found on our website, which is interracialjohn.com. We did not receive any 5-star reviews this week.
The fuck?
What the hell are you guys doing? This
come
is
on.
Getting absurd at this point.
Johnners, come on.
Get
come
on it.
Come on.
I'm going to start calling people out. So you're all on watch.
I'll just say this. Carl.
I'm gonna go by
Carl,
name.
Carl did a 5-star review.
Carl did.
In
God
fact,
bless
it
you,
was,
Carl.
What is it? It wasn't that he demands?
No.
Most defiantly. Most defiantly 5 stars. Come on.
Defiantly 5 stars.
You can't. You can do that.
Yeah.
Somebody can do that.
He meant definitely. Anyways. So shout out to Carl. But this is beyond a special episode.
It's an amazing episode.
It's just beyond. We have the most specialist of guests with us. Innes Smith is in the house. What's going on, Innes?
Not much, family. Not much. Glad to be here. Glad to be here with my buddy.
Sweet mate.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited to just have you on the show. Innes is a musician, blogger, writer, and Christian activist. He writes short stories, testimonies, devotionals, and articles to spread the gospel of Christ. You can find his work on several blogs, including Walking by Faith, Writing with the Lord, Bro E on the Beat, faithwriters.com, and swaggerforchrist.com. As a musician, Innes uses his talents for producing 80s hip-hop influenced keyboard harmonies and tight beats to produce and release his first EP, The Sheep in Wolf's Clothing, a 6-track album of Christian hip-hop songs touching on a variety of life situations from a biblical perspective. And if you listened to the show a couple of episodes ago, Drew mentioned Innes being his college suite mate.
Hey, you know, before we get into that, you mentioned The Sheep in Wolf's Clothing. And
yes.
Can I play the song he wanted?
Well,
to...
no, let me just say, just so people have some context,
and then you can do your thing.
This is like a constant thing with you.
A constant thing?
What is it?
That's the flow. You were talking about the album. Play the song from the album is all I'm saying.
Gosh, you gotta let me get through the intro part first.
The intro part.
We have our show plan.
Okay.
Anyways, everyone. So if you don't know, that's why Innes is on the show. He and Drew were sweet mates. We're going to totally get into all of this as we get later in the show. But they reconnected very recently via Twitter. Drew was telling the story of his friendship with Innes, and he's spoken about him many times since over the years that I've known him. And I'm just so excited to have Innes here and have you guys, you know, talk about your experiences together and what you guys have been up to since then. And I'm just really excited. So welcome, Innes. Welcome to the John.
We need an applause.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. Now, Drew.
We're thrilled to have you here,
yes,
dude.
We really are.
I won't besmirch and say how many years, but It's been some years.
It's been a few years. Yes.
But you know what? Look at it this way. It's a testament to friendship. True friendship never dies.
It's the
absolutely.
Truth.
Well, let me play.
So, yeah. So now is a good time to do that. So
The Sheep in Wolf's Clothing. And you can find it at EnnesSmithBandcamp.com. And so let's do.
And what's the track name?
So this is track 3, Let Me Show You.
And Innes, do you want to do an intro for it or anything?
Let Me Show You is a special track near and dear to my heart because not just me running my mouth over the beats, but it's actually my family is involved. Oh. I have my oldest son, Tomat, who is an up-and-coming rapper, Christian rapper, goes by the name of T1TO, who's the guiding verse. I have my youngest son, Isaiah, singing the hook. I have my youngest daughter, Jordan, playing flute. So it is a very special track.
Oh, yes. That's fantastic.
Fantastic. Well, here we go.
We choose to serve you. Want to be accepted when my time is due. Blessings on my son, Lord, teach him how to stand. Grow him up into a godly man.
Let me show you a world beyond your heavy smoke. I'm trying to coat rolling stones for your antidote. But the antidote puts you in a sad slope. No room for hope with the faith that shows the cost the most. You're winding growth because your life is so miserable. Living with regrets and the list is so expendable. I wish this is staying so repeatable. The past is the past, the future present, so it's time to go. Oh, Israel, your life is so cynical. 11-day journey turning to a 4-0. See, I loved you before you loved me. Heard your prayers, felt your tears, so I sent you free. And now you grieve, but you wanna start to doubt me. Give me what you want, and now you forgot about me. Yeah, this is what I think the Lord would say. Let me show you before you fall astray.
Gotta find that place in my heart I can turn to.
Let me show you.
Turn to your grace, cause there's so much I go through.
Let me show you.
Guide me just strength to do things I'm afraid to do.
Dude,
wow, that's so awesome.
I'm gonna wind it down here at this bridge, I guess it is. You have to go to Bandcamp, Ennis Smith Bandcamp.
We'll have all the links on the show notes, of course. And you can find this on Twitter too at Ennis_C_Smith. But yeah, oh my gosh.
That blows my mind. You did everything on that, right? Like, it was like you did the beats, you did the samples, the tracks, and then your daughter's playing the flute, your other son's rapping. That's incredible.
Yep, I did. And that's like homegrown. There were no samples in it. We produced everything.
Wow.
So cool.
And it's, got a powerful message to it. So I do. I hope. I've had some really good feedback on it. I had one guy who actually sent me an email and said, this track came to me right on time. I needed this message. Thank you for producing. And I was like, right there.
That's what makes it worth it, really, When you can touch somebody like that, that's amazing. That's awesome. I'm really impressed. So you mentioned that we connected, I guess, on Twitter, but really it was an Ask FM question that somebody had submitted. Shout out to my friend Anastasia. Do you remember the first real moment of clarity regarding race and privilege? And I said, wow, there's been so many incremental steps along the way. My biggest was in a college course in my minor, which was social work, and a discussion of Peggy McIntosh's Backpack of Invisible Privilege. That same day, and I put in big caps, don't do this, I asked my black suite mate a host of questions. I really put him on the spot inappropriately by making him answer for all black people. I asked about Miss Black America pageant, wearing symbols of Africa, all the dumb white shit. But he listened, he obliged my ignorance, and he really educated me. I can remember it like it was yesterday. And then I said, I wish he and I could connect again someday. I'd thank him and I'd apologize for my ignorance. So I was like, why am I wishing? I'll just, do a, Google's pretty powerful. Let me do a search. And I actually found your Twitter account. And I was like, this has to be the same, Ennis. And I think I even might have seen the Bandcamp page and saw a picture. I know that's definitely him. So I tweeted you and I guess we've connected, and here we are on the show. I think it's amazing. It's so cool.
That's God, man. I mean, I would call it what it is. That's what that is. So I get the tweet, right? And Drew's message was something like, "Are you the Anna Smith that used to live in Garneau Hall at Western Michigan?" And I'm looking at this and I'm going, it can't possibly be. It can't possibly be. My Andy, my sweet mate, you know, from like freshman year at Western Michigan University. So I go through and I'm reading up on the article. And as I'm reading what he wrote, like these memories are coming back as they were yesterday. I remember this conversation that we had. And I remember he seemed so like embarrassed for asking this stuff, but at the same time, he had this curiosity that was just intriguing, and it was like, well, why would I not answer? This guy's my friend, you know, he's cool. So why would I not answer whatever questions he's got?
I appreciate it.
I'm going to stop you guys, actually, from going any further into this conversation, because we're going to get into a full Innes and Andy interview.
You know, I feel like I ablated from my memory that I went by Andy my freshman year in college, because I was Drew by my sophomore year. It was very quick that I went to Drew. In fact, I tried to go to Andrew in the middle of my freshman year, and it didn't take. And I was just like, no, I'm not going to do Andy. Like, I hate Andy.
We're going to spend a lot of time, and I'm going to kind of treat you guys as interview subjects, because I kind of want Drew, you to fall back and not have to worry about what to say next, except for answering my questions. So we will be getting into it.
Fall back. Am I overbearing? I apologize.
No, you're not. No, but you're the co-host. But for that portion, you're going to not be. You're going to be the guest.
I got
you. So I don't want to use up too much of the goodness in discussing it now. But needless to say, we did, and I don't know if you heard, but we did read your a good portion of your blog post on the show the day that you wrote it.
Oh, man.
Because it really touched Drew that night when you wrote it and when he read it.
I got to be honest. And I'm not trying to be like, you know, unmanly.
I'm not even going to ask you because you'll lie. I'm going to ask. That's what he cried.
I was going to, that was the next words come out of my mouth. That brought me to tears.
It really touched him a lot. So anyway, so we'll get into it. Let's do.
He's going to go right to Leslie. You're good.
Smart man. He knows what's up. Yeah, of course. So, but let's get through some of this regular stuff in the show first, and we'll knock that out, and then we'll get right to the Innes and Andy.
And do the news?
Let's do it.
Come on.
So, St. Patrick's Day was this week.
Yep.
And reminded me of a story I'd heard a while back, and this is by Akilah Hughes. She grew up in a mid-sized suburb in Kentucky, and she was like the only black person in almost all of her classes. There was like 50 out of 2,000 students were black in her school, high school. And so Black History Month was always like the worst thing for her, not because of the subject matter, but because when you're the only black person in class during Black History Month, like everything looks at you. It's always like this big thing. So she got fed up her junior year on St. Patrick's Day after another exhausting Black History Month of pulling double duty as both teacher and student. She decided to make a funny shirt that said, "Kiss me, I'm black." It was purple, and she just used like puffy paint, and she just wore it to school on St. Patrick's Day. So the first half of the day went fine. She had, you know, some kids were high-fiving her, saying they loved it. She heard a few, you know, inappropriate snickers from some people as well. But a teacher kept reading the shirt aloud as "Kiss me, I'm Irish," intentionally, because she doesn't know why, but he kept doing it. And it was obviously racially motivated. So towards the end of the day, her principal pulls her aside and says, "If you wear this shirt in school again, you're going to get suspended." She says, "Why?" And he says, "Because it's offensive and not everyone can wear one."
Everyone can wear one.
She says,
"What's
of course.
Do with anything?
But everyone wears Kiss Me, I'm Irish shirts and none of them get suspended." And he just said, "Don't wear it again." So,
And she's totally cute and the shirt's done really well and it's got like a heart on it. Come on. What the hell?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell?
Yeah. So let's
and
just.
And just why? What is with this? Like, there was now. And did you read, Leslie? There's another school that had a decision to have a black only student event for you know justice and Black Lives Matter, and you know white people getting all up in arms, like just like at the Tia school.
Which they're not letting go, by the way.
No, of course not. They're having people having to apologize for it. It's just, God, I just, where's my button? Where is this? I got
white people. White people.
Golly.
Ennis, where do you live, and what's the racial mix there? What's it like where you live? You're in Michigan, but Southwest Michigan, Northwest, where?
It's Southeast Michigan. We're right outside of Detroit.
Okay.
And actually, we have a pretty diverse makeup of everybody. We got whites, we got blacks, we got Latinos, we got some of everybody. So I guess my kids in high school, I can use them as an example. You know, they don't have to deal with some of the stuff that we had to deal with being not getting our age away, but you know, when we were coming up, we had to deal with this. And I think the thing that I think what I have to say is, unfortunately, this doesn't surprise me. You know, this incident that happened with Aquila, what it proves to me and everybody who read this story is that racism is alive and well. It just is. You know, for the head administrator, the principal, come on, seriously?
Seriously.
Of course. There's always, that's his role.
Right.
That's, you know, and I hate to say it, especially at educational institutions, but we talk, Leslie and I, and I've talked to other people about the history of policing and law enforcement and the direct correlation to, you know, Fugitive Slave Act and, you know, slave patrols and, you know, like officer overseer. That's not like a coincidence, right? And in the same sense, our educational system, we don't talk about it in quite these terms, but it's got a pretty shitty history, right? Like, you know, people of color were denied the right to read and write. You know, educating a black person was a crime. You know, Jim Crow, separate, you know, facilities. Even to a degree now, we're dealing with a segregation of sorts of communities and dollars and hoarding of opportunity by white people. So it's, you know, education's...
And at a more base level, just the education
the
is
education
just
you get is
incorrect as well.
It's a white-centric,
white-centric, white supremacist-based...
What I'm driving at is education in everything about it, in its infancy, in its history, in its curricula, in its principles and practices in education. It's, you know, it's an institution that's steeped in supremacy to support and reinforce anti-blackness and supremacy, you know?
But that's America, though.
Yeah,
just saying. I mean there isn't an institution or system in America that's not steeped in supremacy.
My house.
That's true. You're right. I cleared all that shit out a while ago.
I don't know if our house is a system.
I don't know if it's a system. I don't think it will continue on its own without us here. Maybe Beatrice can take over. That's our dog. The good thing I wanted to just say was that, as a follow-up to the story, was that Aquila told her mom that evening, and of course she was just as mad. She had worked in education for 20 years. The story got picked up in the Cincinnati Inquirer. Of course, the principal declined to be interviewed, and her mother made sure she wore. Yeah, of course, and her mother made sure she wore the shirt at least once a week for the rest of the year. So yeah. So she also had a hand lettering artist design a very fancy looking "Kiss Me, I'm Black" T-shirt, and you can purchase one. And I will put that link on the show notes, so you can buy one for yourself if you're black and you would like to celebrate yourself. Which you
know,
should.
And I'm just gonna say kudos to her for wearing it once a week and then making a T-shirt, and you know, actually like getting the public behind this and not getting, you know, taking advantage of it in this regard. Good outcome. Good for her.
So, the next thing I wanted to talk about was, you guys know that Robin Thicke and Pharrell were ordered to pay like $7.2 million to Marvin Gaye's estate and family last week, right? Yeah, you guys are aware of this.
It is, and just
blurred
sidebar,
lines controversy. Yeah.
But sidebar, isn't it a little bit, I don't want to say like strange, but something rings hollow and weird that his family's suing for him on his behalf for money, but like his family kind of killed him.
Well, his dad killed him. It's not his family. It's his daughters that are getting it. What are you talking about? Stop talking crazy. Well, I mean, it is. It's his heirs, but I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with his dad that killed him. Anyways, Yeah, obviously, if you've heard the two songs, there's no, I mean, it's been proven in a court of law.
Yeah, so it's kind of
irrelevant at this point. But Jay Smoove, who does a weekly, I think it's a
video series.
Blog, a blog series he does called The Ellipsis, kind of used this as an analogy for racists right now. So I'm going to just play the beginning of it.
America, I need your help with something. I don't know if you've been following the whole situation in Oklahoma with the fraternity and the N-word and the hanging from the tree, but I have a problem. Here's the thing. I make videos. I make little commentaries where I talk about our society in ways I feel like we're screwing up a little bit. Nowadays, I'm making two new videos every month for the Fusion Network, and my problem at the moment is I can't keep making new videos if America keeps screwing up in the exact same way I already talked about in other videos. I'm not asking us to stop screwing up. I know that's not possible, but can we just have a little more originality with our screw-ups? For example, in 2008, I made a video named How to Tell Someone They Sound Racist, in which I argued that if you say or do something that is racist, you are then accountable for that thing you did that was racist, regardless of whether you believe that deep down in your heart, you are a racist. And then I acted out a kind of over-the-top satirical version of how that conversation goes when people confuse what you did with who you are.
I have known this person for years, and I know for a fact that they are not a racist, and how dare you claim to know what's inside their soul just because they made one little joke about watermelon tap dancing and going back to Africa.
Okay, so obviously I was just exaggerating for effect there, and in real life, nobody would ever deny racism that blatant, right? While it may be difficult
this for is those parents of Levi
from this video to understand, we know his heart, and he is not a racist. They lacked judgment in a social setting, but they should not be tarred and feathered as racists.
That freak. Jeez,
that was, of course, a quote from the SAEOU chapter's lawyer. I'll stop the video there. He goes on to just follow up his point of just saying, stop doing the shit he already told you to stop doing.
Six years ago. Yeah, a long time ago.
Oh my gosh. Ines, you have to talk about this stuff with your kids. Like, you have kids in high school, you said, not to date you, but, yep. You know, do they talk to you about this stuff? What do they think about this whole, SAE, fraternity song, you know, thing?
You know what? That is one that I actually have not talked to them about. And I think that's on my part because I'm still processing it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, that was just blatant.
Yeah.
You know, to watch that, a bus full of these kids. You know, and I've seen subsequently reports where the head guy for the fraternity has come up and said, oh, you know, I'm appalled by what they were doing, and we're going to offer sensitivity training to all the, okay, come on. You knew what was going on. You didn't know that you had this within your organization. Now you're appalled because it's out in the open.
Right.
Yep.
So, you know, that's something I definitely have to talk to my kids about, but it's kind of like, how do I go about explaining it, especially to a nine-year-old, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, my nine-year-old son, his mom is white, his dad is black, and we just watched Roots for the first time, you know, as a family last year. That was interesting. You know, I already seen it. I've seen it for years, but that was the first time that my wife and my kids actually sat up and watched like the whole series. And for them, it was like, oh, this is what life is really about.
Mm. Wow. No, I got to wait a minute. Just time out for a second.
Hmm.
Is your wife white or the mother of your son white? Or both one of the same?
She is as Italian as they come.
I cannot believe you're in an interracial relationship.
What do you mean you can't believe? What am I supposed to mean?
Not called coincidence, but how were I didn't know it until now. Not that you'd ask it, and that's it.
You
that's
don't know what I was going to ask.
I know you'd ask, but that's the, so. This is not ironic, but I have often made fun of a couple friends of mine when Leslie and I started dating, where I didn't come out and say, "Oh, by the way, my girlfriend's black."
Oh, just, right.
You don't like it's like the first thing that would come out of my mouth, like, oh, you know, Leslie's black. And we didn't have Facebook back in those days, so there weren't like pictures online and shit. So there's at least one, maybe like three friends that were like, you're like, oh, nice to meet you. And they'd be like, the fuck, dude, you didn't tell us she was black. Not that I care, it doesn't matter, but like, it's been like 2 months. But come on, I've been talking about it on the phone and shit. Like, so I'm now doing that in reverse.
Yeah, I don't know when it comes up naturally.
It doesn't.
Unless you are being grilled or whatever. Yeah, that's true.
Hey, it's funny. I don't know if you guys experience it, but every now and then, it's funny when we're out, we'll still get the looks. It's like the devil takes us home.
Oh, yeah. We get the looks, too. You guys, I imagine, get it worse, which is a weird thing that Drew and I talk about all the time, actually. That there's this, and it's such a strange thing, but I have, what do I always say, Drew? Oh, that we're more respected as an interracial couple, a black woman with a white man.
Versus a black man.
By society, in reverse, it's...
Oh, we catch hell.
Right.
It automatically becomes, you know, it's like...
It's true. Well, which makes perfect sense because Drew, as the white male, should get to do whatever the fuck he wants to do.
No.
Well, nobody needs to tell him what to do. So if it's something that he's decided to do, it should be more respectable just because that's how both patriarchy and supremacy work.
I was going to say, there's a lot of variables at play. And I think there's a couple things that I see that in a black man, white woman that I don't always see in a black woman, white man relationship. In particular, is flack from the black community, from other people of color, right? So, like, I don't know why, but I feel like black men that date white women seem to get more flack from other black folks than black women that date white men. Maybe I'm wrong.
I would agree with that. I've seen it personally.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I do. I will say, if I had to pick a segment of the population that has given us the most strife, it's been black men, which is also very interesting. In Chicago, in particular, when we first started dating, I think it's a lot more commonplace, especially on the East Coast. But when we were in the Midwest, I thought it was a little more.
You know, and the only city I ever met, and maybe, you know, maybe our relationship has changed and my, you know, I'm giving off a different vibe or something. But Chicago is the only city where people would try to dirty Mac. And it was.
They would,
and
it too.
It was always like black men.
Blatant.
Yeah, it was bad.
I don't get that. Don't dirty Mac people's wives, people.
Don't do that.
Get yourself together.
We weren't married then, though.
Well, whatever. No. Girlfriends. If somebody's on a date with somebody, don't dirty Mac them.
So it's a little lingo. Dirty Mac is trying to pick up somebody's girl that's obviously with somebody else.
Yeah, that you know is with somebody. Yeah. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to talk about was Illinois, well, former Illinois. Representative Aaron Schock, who has been a guest star in his own right, if not in real life, on this particular program, because we covered extensively his Downton Abbey-inspired office in the Rayburn House office building with pheasant feathers and a bust of home state president Abraham Lincoln.
Did you hear anything about that, Ennis? Are you up to speed on that at all?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so...
My wife and I were just talking about this dude yesterday.
Ridiculous.
It's just a joke.
So that happened, and then his PR person had these racist tweets, and he resigned.
But I think that it was He had that shit secretly done years ago and kept hidden in private and then unhid it. It's like a falling on his sword. I think he's the best PR guy in the
Yeah, MLS. Well, he didn't fall far enough because this dude has, since February 2nd, which is when that post piece ran, has just had nothing but...
Yeah, it's been a nightmare for
him. I mean, first... USA Today in Political Detail, his lavish but legal spending at pricey hotels in Las Vegas, San Francisco, and Miami Beach for campaign purposes. And he also spent, they said, more than $90,000 in campaign dollars on private air charters, usually a high sum for a regular person that's in the house. And he's a freshman as well. He's new on the scene. Then he launches his own internal review of tens of thousands of dollars in reimbursements he received for using his official vehicle.
Mm-hmm. He did his own review of his own taking. Okay. That's He's balling, man.
He brings on two prominent Washington defense lawyers and a public relations firm to battle the brewing controversy over his use of campaign and official accounts. He declined to answer when asked about a 2011 trip to London in which he stayed at a five-star hotel where the cheapest room went for $500 a night.
I mean, this dude was just balling.
I mean,
for real, for real.
It also showed he was scheduled to visit very expensive clothing store and dined at Windsor Castle and Buckingham Palace while in London. Because we all do that. It comes out that he never disclosed receiving dinner or drinks during his London trip.
Well, just $500 a night, but not dinner. I mean, Jesus. A $90,000 jet. Okay. $90,000 for the jet. All right. I own that. $500 a night? I did have an appointment with Bergdorf's, but I canceled it. I didn't go.
Yeah.
And I didn't do dinner and drinks. I didn't do dinner and drinks.
What am I, an animal? On February 27th, he suspended his fundraising. On that same day, Political reports that he spent $15,000 in government money for private flights between October and December.
But did they have dinner and drinks?
$15,000. On March 1st, the Chicago Sun-Times reports that he used taxpayer money to fly from Peoria to Chicago for a Bears game.
Yo, that's a 3-hour drive.
From Peoria to Chicago.
Maybe it's a 5-hour drive.
Come on. That's insanity.
And this is, Illinois has such a history of governors.
It's like insane with Illinois. Galore. I'll keep going because we'll take us through this week. March 6th, more details about his internal spending surface. As some in his circle and House Republican Congress fear he could face an ethics committee investigation. He holds a news conference, but he doesn't tell the national media, which is always a good move. March 9th, Politico finds that he misreported his payment for a private flight, indicating the more than $3,000 as a software expenditure for that Bears game.
That's a software expenditure?
In reality, it's even worse because the $3,000 was a deposit in addition to the $10,000 that he had previously disclosed that he was billed for the flight.
Come on. As software?
It just gets worse and worse. On March 11th, Politico asked the congressman in his home district whether he thought he had broken any rules or federal regulations. He says, well, I certainly hope not. I'm not an attorney.
That was the answer.
I hope I didn't.
And what else are you going to say? Alice is right. Alice is dead on.
Yeah. And then investigators on the 16th, they open up investigation. And of course, as they expected, in the Office of Congressional Ethics, Politico reports that he asked him about tens of thousands of dollars of questionable mileage reimbursements. And then the next day he resigned, effective March 31st. So the big thing that's going to get him is this expenditure for his vehicle. So he
basically, not the $90,000
no,
jet.
No, because this is all like totally, you can just see it. He billed the federal government for 170,000 miles in his personal car from January 2010 to 2014. But then when he sold it, there were only 80,000 miles on the odometer.
Oh, no. He sold it? Duh.
So he,
That's greedy.
Yeah.
That's greedy, man.
It's like, what did you just have? Like, what's the most they let you do a month? That's what I'm doing. Because I don't know how else you get to that much. Like, literally. Hey, what's Marge, would you pull up the handbook? Let me know. What's the maximum I can charge in mileage per month?
I just want to make sure.
Yeah. That's how much I drove.
That's literally just at the government's, like, and I'm sure they got more than the standard, like, you know, IRS tax, whatever. But it's like, I think it's like 40 or something cents a mile. That's 80 grand. He got 80. Yeah. That he billed the government $80,000, and then wanted to sell the goddamn car on top of it. I mean, what the fuck? You got 80 grand. That's just greedy.
So bad.
It's so greedy.
So bad. So yeah. Apparently, he's given back that money, all of the money he was paid for travel. But
I have a really, really very serious, important question I want to ask.
That's.
Who gets the Downton Abbey office?
Somebody's getting it come March 31st. And now I feel bad for that poor designer. It was a feather in her cap, no pun intended, for her, you know, her design form, which was called, what was it called? Something Euro Trash, I think it was called. Literally, I'm not joking. That's what it was called, Euro Trash. Oh, goodness.
Good Lord.
Aaron, we hardly knew ye.
Yeah, we, but the
you know what's the saddest thing about Aaron Schock, though, is he was supposed to be like a mover, shaker, up and comer. He was like on the cover of Men's Health magazine. He was supposed to be a you know heir apparent in the in the party. So it's not good. Not good. Dude. Not a good look.
Aaron, you get the
yeah, please.
Yeah, dang, Aaron, you're done, dude.
Dang. So, but that's good. But and other things.
Okay. Lame duck blackness is upon us, people. Get used to it. Obese, he's just been, you know, letting it go. He went on to Jimmy Kimmel this past week.
Mean tweets.
And read mean tweets. Let's tweets. Give our president a few minutes of our time here. Mean tweets.
Online, the people who already don't like the president are criticizing him for coming here. President Bush would get the same thing when he did TV shows. It's the nature of the job, I guess, especially now that we have Twitter. But I think it's important to remember that presidents are people, too. And from time to time, we give celebrities a chance to read some of the mean things people tweet about them. And tonight, we extended that same courtesy to our commander-in-chief. And with that said, it's time now for an all-President Obama edition of Mean Tweets.
Obama's hair is looking grayer these days. Can't imagine why, since he doesn't seem to be one bit worried about all that's going on.
No.
The music.
Is there any way we could fly Obama to some golf course halfway around the world and just leave him there? Well, RW is Surfer Girl. I think that's a great idea. A 30-rack of Coors Light is $23 now at SunStop. Thanks, Obama. How do you make Obama's eyes light up? Shine a flashlight in his ears.
You laughed at that one.
Somebody send Obama some life hacks on how to be a good president.
Oh.
Ha ha. Like, I bet that would help. LOL. You know, the LOL is redundant.
He's trolling the bed.
I'm all right with the president wearing jeans. I'm not all right with the president wearing those jeans.
Can I just say something?
Jimmy's got the jeans on.
I don't think there's anything wrong with the jeans you wear.
Jimmy, I think we've got a point.
Those jeans. So the most powerful man in the free world is making notes of all these tweets.
He really... He is so funny, man. He's got such a great sense of humor. I can't wait to see what he does when he is out of. I will say that episode or the tweets segment generated more than 10 million views in its first 24 hours on the Jimmy Kimmel Live YouTube. And it also was Jimmy's highest rated show ever. So,
you know, someone said the other day that they're looking forward to a ex-president Obama, like having a former black president.
Yes.
You know, just out in the...
Out in the ether.
In the ether, yeah.
Yes, just out
there. And I hadn't contemplated that. I was like, and young. Because he's younger than Bill Clinton was,
he
right?
He is, yes.
All right.
Yeah.
He got a lot to do. And I'll say this, the Organizing for America, OFA, which is his, you know, basically what his campaign arm turned into once, you know, he won both of them. Once that happened, they turned into this other thing called Organizing for America, and they have been... increasing their activity, not decreasing, over the last 6 months. I think they have big plans. I'll say that. I think it's going to be really interesting to see. So the other thing he did this week was he went to the annual Gridiron Dinner and had some hot takes about Hillary Clinton and her emails.
Yeah, he had another joke. He said, he goes, I'm not saying I'm going to be funnier. I'm just saying they legalized lead here in D.C.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what he said. He said about... Hillary, he said, let's see, at the annual Gridiron Dinner in Washington, he reminisced about how much the technological landscape has changed since 2008 when he ran against Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination. Mm. Back then, I was the young, tech-savvy candidate of the future, he said. Now I'm yesterday's news, and Hillary has a server in her house. I didn't even know you could get one of those in your house. I'm so far behind. I would have gotten one.
Server.
Mm-hmm. And he says, I think 2016 will come down to the issues. For example, equal pay. Did you know that the average male presidential candidate earns $150,000 less per speech than a woman doing the same job? It's terrible. We've got to fix that. Jokes.
Jokes.
Jokes. And then he went after Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. He says Scott has had a few recent tumbles, stumbles. The other week he said he didn't know whether or not I was a Christian, and I was taken aback. But fortunately, my faith teaches us forgiveness. So, Governor Walker, assalamu alaikum. Trolling.
I hadn't heard that one. That's awesome. But did you hear what Walker said when he came out? He said, because you know Giuliani had made the comment that Obama doesn't love America, and it was at a Walker presser or some sort of event with Walker. And
yeah,
Walker. What does Walker think? He hasn't come out and said anything, so he took the opportunity to say, "I just want to go on the record and say I know President Obama loves America, and he loves everyone in America except Rudy Giuliani."
Yeah. But he went back to Scott again. He said that his Scott Walker also got some heat for staying silent when Rudy Giuliani said, I don't love America, which I also think is a problem. Think about it, Scott. If I did not love America, I wouldn't have moved here from Kenya. End quote. Yeah. Hot takes. So that was Lame Duck Blackness this week.
Dude. Oh, BZ.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God. The worst segment we do.
Every time.
It's the worst.
Every time, but let me get my cue up. Bad boys,
what you want, what you gonna do?
Yes, all cops. Yes, all cops. And now in Michigan, in your neck of the woods, our soon-to-be neck of the woods.
Yes, very soon-to-be neck of the woods, because it's exactly where we're moving to.
Grand Rapids.
Right. Yes.
So why don't you... I'll let you tell the story.
I'll let you do this one, Drew.
I'll have to pull it up. But essentially, a Michigan woman says that a cop raped her in bed with her infant daughter there. And I won't even want to like go into the details, but it was... you know, horrible, choking her, you know, calling her all sorts of, you know, horrible names. And then at some point saying, you know, like, F you for, you know, making me love you, you horrible, you know, like, again, epithets.
He called her a ghetto piece of shit is what he called her while he was doing this to her. And, you know, again, you don't need, like you said, Drew, you don't need to go into the whole thing. But she mentioned that she was scared to call the police because he was a cop.
Yeah.
And they had been dating, so this was a relationship they had, and then they had broken it off. And then he came to her house with her saying, "No, don't come there to the house." And then the attack occurred.
Here's the thing that's a problem for me, and so and there's a confluence of many things, and you know we already know as a society we have a real issue with blaming the victim when it comes to rape.
Yeah.
In particular, you know, this maybe falls slightly into date rape because they were at some time in a consensual relationship.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying it is date rape. I'm just, you know, there's, for whatever reason, that's how society's viewing some of these things differently. And the, you know, blaming the victim, all that stuff's there with rape. It's all right there. And now we've got a black woman and a white guy, race, we've got police and brutality. It's all of these things commingled. And because it's, again, just sort of like a he said, she said, you know, and oftentimes it's a police narrative versus a person that's dead. But in this instance, you know, she was just raped and she's able to, you know, press charges later, but didn't do it right away because she was, you know, freaking scared. He's a cop. She knows she got buddies on the force. Like, what is she going to do, right? Like, she has not a lot of resources. And it's almost like a racial Rorschach test. People are just right down the line. They're making, you know, based on implicit bias and assumptions. And I'll be honest, I have, you know, at this point in my life, I now have a certain opinion of individuals with power and influence, and in particular law enforcement officers. And, you know, I'm inclined to believe her. You know, that's just me. And I know there's a lot of other people that are inclined to believe him. And it's, but it's just like a divining ride, like straight down, like, psh, and it's, and the comments, oh, if you ever want to be grotesque, read comments at the bottom of these kind of stories. Because people just get really, you know, they're just deep into their opinion about this is what happened. And so now he's saying, the police officer saying that it was consensual and that was her preference was to have rough intercourse with choking and, you know, slapping and humiliation.
You know. Because, you know, that's what most people like to do is go through the trouble of bringing charges against a officer of the law and having your entire personal sexual sure. history dissected in public. Because that's an easy it's really thing. Fun. Yeah. So I could see why you would just do that for no reason.
Just like, ha-ha, just because, you know, fuck you, I'm going to do
it's
this.
It's awesome. Because yeah. no one in her town's ever going to look at her differently.
And I don't say this in any other way other than like realistically, the likelihood of success is like slim to none. So she knows that, and her lawyer knows that. You don't just do this to like, haha, let's just do it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Absolutely.
So yes, all friggin' cops.
Yeah. So we've come to the fun part of the show.
Let's do something enjoyable.
Shake it off. Where I'm going to interview you guys, so you can just shush it now.
I'm ready.
All right. I'm joined today by one Andy McFadden.
Stop.
And Ennis Smith. And so I wanted to just talk to you both about your experience at WMU, a little bit generally speaking, and then more specifically about your interactions with each other. And hopefully we can hear two sides of the same story and come out the end with a nice, clear three-dimensional picture of you know, kind of what you meant or didn't mean to each other, and also kind of what reverberations there are on your lives today based on you guys interacting. Okay, so
fire away.
That's hot. You set the bar high.
I did, but you know, I'm a good interviewer, so it's all good. So first of all, Ennis, tell us a little bit about your background. Where did you go to high school, and kind of what was your interaction with people of other races? And obviously, I mean, being a black person, you interact with white people, generally speaking. But did you go to a predominantly black high school? Did you play sports? What? Tell us a little bit about your background.
Born and raised, East Corus, Michigan. It is a small, very small suburb of Detroit, southeast side. My neighborhood was pretty much split down the middle. Just a melting pot of everybody. So we had blacks, whites, Latinos on our high school. Racism was not really an issue in my high school because everybody knew everybody and we all got along.
How many people are we talking about? Drew, you don't get to answer that question.
I want to know how many people.
Nice try. How many people?
Now, that actually plays into where we're going later on when we get to college, because I didn't learn that racism was the hotbed topic that it was until I got out on my own in college, because my parents didn't raise us to be that. You know, my parents. Mother and father. I'm the oldest of three. And we didn't talk racism. The only thing that my parents taught us was respectable, period. No matter what color they are, you know, no matter who they are, you respect people. To feel people view that they should not be respected. So there was no designation, if I could use that word, as to, okay, you're black, you gotta be this way. They're white, you have to treat them that way.
Gotcha.
Now, the flip side of that coin was, Black history was not really a topic in my house either. So it was like, all right, I know I'm black, you know. I know that that lady over there is white, and I know that we look different, but I'm going to treat you different. So it wasn't really until I got to college that it became an issue. I was a nerd in school. I could fall on an A. I was lazy, so I had to work to get that A. But not because studying hard was late. So
we was all kind of nerdy back in the day. I know I was. I was. I had a picture. Someone took a picture of me. I was just like, oh my God, don't ever let that picture get like on Facebook. That's so, like,
and I promptly put it on Facebook immediately.
You put it on Facebook
immediately.
I feel your pain.
So talk to me then a little bit about the transition then. When you got to school, like, when did you say, whoa, this atmosphere racially is different than what I'm used to? What made you notice that shift?
Day one, freshman year, 1991, I would say August, I had a roommate by the name of Bill who was just straight. He was weird beyond weird. And it wasn't until years later that I found out why he was weird. He was gay, and he was very introverted.
Mm.
So there was no, how should I say, inappropriate strangeness about him. You know, we got along, but his culture was a lot different than mine. And with that, when I came across people that became my friends who looked like me, they made it perfectly clear that, yeah, you don't associate with people like that. You know, they look different than you. We are who we are. They are who they are. So really, the racial divide came to life for me, like, in a big way my freshman year in college. And it was kind of hard for me to deal with because that just wasn't how I was raised. My wife now, just like I was ever married before, my wife and I dated in high school. And, you know, so in the back of my mind, there was that. Like, how they going to be a big time take a fight or they not have a relationship. Maybe I just going to keep that in my back pocket. So it was. It became apparent to me really early, freshman year.
Yo, I mean, it was difficult for me. Do you remember... Honest to God, so Ennis and I were only suite mates for one semester because I moved across the hall to another guy named Bill's room and was suite mates with Todd and Chad.
Right.
But so at the time, my roommate was this cat named Tony. And between him, Tony and Bill were the two, like, biggest weirdos on
the
whole
hall.
Was
Tony the bodybuilder guy?
Yeah, he was a wrestler.
Oh,
he
right.
had cauliflower
ears. What
was
the song he used to play all the time?
Oh, my God. So
tells all these stories.
He tried to get women. He'd pick up women. Like, the first week, he's like, dude, all these chicks, man. I got these chicks come back to the room, man. These chicks. And he'd put on, like, the soundtrack from Grease and shit and just, like, I don't know, man.
It was weird.
Yeah, just Tony and Bill were just, they were both really kind of strange. Yeah. For very, very. And so you're talking about day one.
So Drew, go, let's take the flip side of this again. You're not driving the conversation.
What?
I am. You need to really let it go. Sir. sir,
please
act like,
please
act proper,
please.
Thank you. You're a guest.
Act proper.
Oh, gosh, can't take you anywhere.
I feel your pain, dude. Just to let you know, you're not alone. I feel you.
So,
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, exactly. So, Drew, tell us the flip side. I'm sure people know a little bit about your background, but just, you know, just say, you know, what kind of environment you grew up in, and then about,
sure,
you know, kind of your first indication that you were in a different atmosphere at Western Michigan.
So I grew up in and as you made a reference, like, you know, in your letter said that it seemed like someone who grew up in a town that, you know, didn't surround or didn't have a lot of people of color. And so the town I grew up in is very, very white. Like
a former sundown town.
It's probably like less than a quarter of a percent. Like literally. Like,
I might look
I went to a high school that had, I want to say, 3,000 people, you know, that I graduated with. Like a huge graduating class. Very large public high school. And at one point, the high school had one of the highest per capita spending per student of any public high school in the country. So, like, you know,
wow.
We're talking like really, you know, really high-end education, very elite. You know, when you say, like, oh, I'm from here, you'd be like, oh, you drive a BMW or a Porsche to school. I'm like, I'd make like, ha-ha, F you. But, like, it's kind of true. Like, the student parking lot had BMWs and Land Rovers and
just
Porsches.
To
and
give you the breakdown on Winnetka, currently it is 96.29% white.
Okay.
It is 0.25%. Yeah, it's 0.25% African American.
I said a quarter percent. I was dead on.
0.02% Native American, 2.43% Asian, and 0.3% other races, and 0.72% for two or more other races, and then 1.26% Hispanic or Latino.
So it was very, very sheltered, very white, and high school was the same way. Like, there, you know, wasn't but like three, like Chris and Nita. There wasn't like, you know, very many people of color in the entire class of 3,000 people compared to my wife, who went to a high school that graduated with 90 some odd people, and she was among like 12 other black people. So they had like four times as many people of color and 150% less student population. But anyway, so that was my background. But my mom's best friend had three biracial children, three black kids, and we would be going on vacations together. Like, we weren't just friends, we were like really close. So it wasn't that I didn't know black people, but I would say their black experience was a lot like my suburban white experience. Very sheltered, very, you know, their mother was white, not in a bad way, just they lived in a white town. So anyway, fast forward to Western Michigan. And likewise, I remember like day one that said roommate Tony said like three different racial epithets. I was like, oh my God, seriously? Like, you know, like just right out the gate. And I was like, wow. And I do remember there was a freshman year, maybe it might have been sophomore year, and maybe you'll remember it better than I do, but there was a – at Western, there was a – was it a step contest? There was some sort of event that was an annual thing for the intra-fraternity council, the, you know, eight or nine black fraternities. And I forget what happened, but did somebody get hurt or injured? There was a fight maybe. Something happened, and I thought there was like – I remember
some like being, racial strife. Yeah, or something. Yeah. Do you remember racial. That?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
What was
yeah,
it?
I do.
What was it?
I do. It was the icebreaker, and annually, the icebreaker at Western Michigan University, black fraternities show up. Mm-hmm. Step show. You know, like the white fraternities had no idea what the step show was, and they don't step.
Right.
You know? But the black fraternities, the step show was like the pinnacle of what the icebreaker was. So I remember this freshman year, something happened. There was a fight. I don't remember who the combatants were, but I know one of them wasn't what the other was, racially speaking, and that just caused a rift across the campus.
Mm.
Like it was a big deal. It really was a big deal. And that, I remember that because, again, like Drew was saying, that was my first experience with that. Mm. So I was like, oh, like, this ain't deep. This is real.
Yeah, and there was something else I remember with a teacher, and I forget what course the teacher was teaching, and I think the teacher was black, and there was some sort of like censure, because remember they had the things where you could fill out and grade the teacher. So there was this, you know, every year there was like a student independent grading of all the teachers kind of thing that the, you know, some organization did, and this individual got always really, really high marks, but they were doing something to censure him, and I forget what it was. And I thought there was a walkout by black students in that class or in that department. It might have been math. I can't remember. I think it was math.
That one I don't remember. I don't remember that. I remember there was a particular professor of black history, Dr. Ben Wilson, that like everybody wanted to go to because they all felt like Dr. Wilson was the guy to go to if you wanted to learn their black history.
Mm.
I remember that. But I don't remember that.
And so, great. This is perfect. I think we have a good kind of setup that the very different backgrounds you both came from,
yep.
But interestingly enough, both of those backgrounds kind of had led you into a place where you hadn't really experienced too much racial strife prior to interacting with each other and with the larger world at Western Michigan. So, okay. I think we got a good picture here. So, Ennis, do you remember the first time you met Andy?
This dude shows up, and I'm trying to remember if I met him in the bathroom, because as sweetmates, I had my dorm room, Andy had his dorm, Drew had his dorm room, and they were connected by a bathroom, right?
Correct.
Remember that?
Yeah.
So, if I remember right, I think we might have met in the bathroom in Bath. And I remember,
sounds about right.
I remember thinking, you know, we kind of shook hands and said, hey, and again, he used to go by Andy at the time. I'm Andy. Hey, okay, I'm innocent. I remember thinking, he said something funny, something that was hilarious. And what I remember about it is he made me laugh at a time where all I can think of is, I want to go home.
Wow.
This whole college thing, you know, day one, day two, is not working out for me. So I come across this guy in the bathroom, you know, passing by. He said something funny after this. introduced ourselves to each other. He said something funny. I laughed, and, you know, we kind of went back our, in our old separate directions. And I remember thinking, okay, he's goofy, he's funny, I guess he's okay. You know, so I guess we can be free. I remember thinking that.
That's my motto today. I think that's your tagline. Goofy and funny?
Goofy, funny, okay.
That's my wheelhouse.
Goofy, funny, okay. Very white guy. Trademarked.
That's what I remember. That's how we, you know, that's how we came across each other. And what's interesting to me today is learning Drew's background. I remember when we were in school, you know, he did not have a hit of fear about being around black folks. You know, he was like this innocent. He just had questions that he just wanted to know. He was always funny. So he was always making us laugh. And at the same time, he had questions. But there was no, I don't know if I should say that. See, I need to ask a certain way around this group of people. You know, there wasn't any of that. And that
what
just made
you're referring to would be tact. Just kidding.
No.
Drew, from your that was Ennis' first memory of you. What's yours of him?
I don't know if it's that same bad. I don't remember anything like specifically. My memory's poorer, foggier. Maybe
foggier.
Hazier.
That's okay. Hazier.
It's hazy. Clouded.
Hazy.
And
very hazy.
I sort of tangentially Western at the time. You know. It was kind of still, like Ennis had said day one, like, you know, the other folks are, hey, like, you know, we don't hang out with, you know, here, there, we black folk keep to ourselves and let, you know, the white people do their thing. It was kind of segregated, not in like a very specific and real way, but, you know, it was like you go down to the lunchroom, there's a, and that's so, as the two bedrooms were connected by a bathroom, two big buildings were connected by a courtyard and a cafeteria, a huge cafeteria. Yep. So we'd all eat at this cafeteria, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people and thousands maybe even. And it definitely would be like, okay, you know, there's a group of black folks sitting over in this area and a bunch of white people sitting over in this area.
And is curious, was that something that was normal at your high school or was that not normal at all? And you said it was pretty mixed.
No, it wasn't. You know, you had your groups that, you know, you had those like, that just, okay, right. You don't look like us, so don't come around. That was just their stilo. But by and large, everybody got along with
it. It was more like the jocks hung out with each other, the whoever hung out with each other. It was more like that.
It didn't matter if they were black or if they were white, they were jocks.
Got it.
And what was the size of your school again? How many people
graduated? I graduated with 51. I was part of a 51.
That's a tight group.
Yeah, that's a very tight group.
It's not that it's hard to have segregation in that group.
Well, I mean, what are you going to segregate yourself by yourself? I mean, it just gets to be ridiculous at some point, which totally makes sense. It's only interesting to me. I only ask because I went to an all-girls boarding school in upstate New York for high school, and this was something that was, and it, even still today at the school, is still kind of like why do all the black people sit together all the time. And a lot of times it's, and I imagine it was like this at Western Michigan, when there's not a lot of you, you know, you tend to want to be in a place of comfort. And in your hometown, you're comfortable because you know everybody. But when you're not, it's a completely different story. And I say all the time, I was like, I know every black person that I went to college with. Every single one of them. Like, by name, they would know who I am because we just knew each other. And that's...
The group of you has a tagline, Blemmas.
Well, that's from high school, not from college. But yes, we do have a tagline in from high school.
Well, so you asked about my first memory. And again, it's like, you know, there's a bunch. And I'd referenced the conversation where I peppered Ennis. And I think it was Al. Was it you and Al that was peppering with questions? Okay. You're still friends with him, right?
Yeah. Al for Gene here. He's doing all right.
What's up, Al?
What up? You should tell him. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So, and I'm going to put
myself. You know
I am. Of course. I'm going to put myself on blast. To this day, and I don't know why, but for some reason, at some point, I referenced that you were eating powdered donuts. You had like a bag of powdered donuts, and I called, and I remember you had your shirt off and eating powdered donuts, and I remember thinking like, oh, those are the donuts Ennis like. And at some point, those are just like quote unquote Ennis donuts. I kid you not, like it's been 20 some odd years.
To this day, there's still Ennis donuts in our household. He's like, oh no, let's get some Ennis donuts.
I'm not even kidding.
Literally referred to as such. That's so funny. Do you still eat the donuts?
I do.
So do
See?
I.
So do you.
I can't eat myself because, you know, I got a house full of kids, but I do.
It's so funny because it's become such a, you know, shorthand for Drew over the years.
Sure.
So let's talk about the discussion, if you will, for lack of a better way. We'll just uppercase T, uppercase D. I'm sure there was a series of them, but we'll talk about the first time, Drew, that you decided you were gonna go and talk with Ennis and Al about this black and white stuff. So I know you mentioned earlier what the impetus was. You had been in this class, and so there was all this stuff going on, and so
sure.
You know, you were kind of
coming. And the environment we've just described.
Exactly. So, but what made you, like, A, if you can remember, that day decide to say something, and then B, what made you think that, or did you even think about the impact it might have on Al and Ennis, which I doubt you did, but
not at all.
Did you choose them specifically?
So I did choose Ennis and Al specifically. Ennis probably because he was my sweet mate, and I, you know, I think we had a rapport. I felt comfortable. And as he said, I wasn't very, and I've never been, you know, shy about wanting to know other people, and you know what I mean. Like that's never been an issue for me. I haven't had a problem with having dialogue and discussion. Like remember when we started dating and we had a big dinner party and we went to like the one place and I'm the only white guy around and that one frontier is like, you know, Drew's like the whitest guy ever, but he's all right. Like remember, like, so it was always like not a big deal for me. But so I asked like, can we talk about this? I hope I was respectful, at least in that regard. Like I want to talk about this and I want to have like, you know, your time. And we might have been in someone's room that maybe it was Al's room. I thought maybe there was like a room on the hall that we all shared, like a little, I don't know what you'd call it, like a study room, like a little shared communal room.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a study room down at the end of the hall.
But I don't know where we had the conversation, but I remember asking to talk about this stuff. And, you know, you were like, okay, sure. And to Leslie's point, admittedly, I didn't for once consider impact on you or Al. It was just sort of that's a very male white perspective, like, well, I want something, I'm gonna go ask for it and get it, like without really thinking about the consequences. This is what I want, so I'm just gonna go get it, in a very almost selfish way. And I do remember being you know, genuine and authentic, but asking just like literally like, why is there a Miss Black America? And what would you I see people wearing, you know, symbols of Africa around. What if I had a symbol of Ireland? It was a eye opening experience because I wanted to know, not like why, like that's a inappropriate way of phrasing what I was asking, but it was more, you know, what's your experience with regards to that? And I want to understand your experience with regards to that. And I remember the Miss Black America specifically, like, and it sounds stupid. It really does, that like a white person at, I don't know, 18, I guess I was at the time, could be in the world and really not understand the need for a Miss Black America is because there's never been a black person elected to. And it might have been like, honestly, I think Vanessa had just gotten, right?
She
like,
probably, yeah, because that was
few years earlier.
Yeah. So, or while you guys were in college, probably was
probably,
when.
But it might have been like people say like, well, you got President Obama now, racism is over. Like I might have been like, well, Vanessa won, why do we need a Miss Black America? Like I don't remember being a jerk about it, but I remember being, you know.
No, it was a while. It was 84 was when she won.
Genuine about it, right. You just genuinely wanted to know. That's what I remember about the discussion that we had is, you know, you didn't come off as condescending. You didn't come off as, I just asked at all. It was just like, this is somebody who genuinely has questions that he wants answered. And what I remember about the conversation, Drew, was Al was getting heated. Like, for whatever reason, he was taking the question personally.
Mm.
That's what I remember about it. And it was like, his answers came sharper and sharper, but he just kept on with the questions. And it was like, there was a certain hilarious element to it.
He's obliviousness.
Back and forth. I'm like, I
want to
see where this goes.
No, but you were. Did you notice that Al was getting heated?
I did, absolutely.
Oh, you did notice?
Of course.
So why didn't you stop?
I didn't stop. He wasn't. And I think I even at one point, didn't we address like why, you know, if you don't want to ask anything? And Ennis was like, no, go ahead, no problem. And Al was probably like, Al, I apologize. And I said, don't do this. I'm you know better, do better. And I certainly know much, 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 much better now. But don't make black people answer questions like that. That's not right.
Well, yeah. Don't, certainly not for the sole purpose of making black people have to teach you about racism. We have Google now, so you can use
that's
that.
That's a
first.
Thing. That's true.
It's a thing. It exists. So
racism school 101.
Google so it. I know that this, you know, obviously carried on a series of conversations that you guys would have, but, and you only were suite mates for that first semester. Mm. But did you continue the dialogue over the year, or what kind of, what was, where did it go from there? Did it continue, or was that kind of like you guys had this specific couple of conversations and that was the long and short?
I don't remember, Ennis. I know there was at least, we talked about this at another point. There's other times we talked about stuff. And we talked about other times.
Yeah, I think that was kind of an isolated conversation. You know, that was like the big one.
Right.
You know what I mean? We had that, and we did. Over the course of our relationship, we talked about different things. It was always open and honest between us. But I think that one conversation was the defining conversation. That was probably, for me, it was like, okay, this is my friend. He genuinely wants to know who I am. And, you know, I'm going to honor him. I answer whatever he has.
Well, I appreciate it.
That's awesome. So, we'll fast forward a little bit, and I'll start with you, Drew. So, you know, you had this moment, and you kind of, I think you personally kind of bring your current journey into social justice and racial equality and being kind of a fighter for those things. You trace it back to these conversations with Ennis and that one in particular. When did you realize that? And was it really more of an hindsight thing, or was it something that had like kind of shifted something in you then? Like what, your perspective?
It was the first time I ever was able to very clearly understand and see kind of like, I would say like whiteness, if that makes it, I don't know how to explain it, but you know, one of the hallmarks of really effective oppression and supremacy is that it's just so like subtle, and it's sort of like, you don't realize that, like, you know, I would say now the way I describe it is that white is the default, the normative. It's held up as the standard, and it's made so that you don't ever have to look outside of that. You can frame everything within your own white worldview, every question, everything you want to understand and think about. So it's never really – it's very comfortable. It's very easy. And I remember I guess maybe even – this maybe is more appropriate. I would say it was one of the first for me as a person – where I really kind of saw, aside from, you know, I almost feel like they're sisters. They were so close to family. But I felt just different about me and myself and thinking about other people. It was very, I can remember it, like I said, like it was yesterday. And I've referenced it many times outside of answering that question on Ask FM, right?
Absolutely. And Ennis, did you find it changed your potential opinion about the white people on campus at WMU, or did you think Drew was just an outlier?
This is the amazing thing about how perception is in the eye of the beholder. Because while I remember that one conversation that we had as like the defining conversation of our relationship, it disappeared from my mind like for years. But the minute that it did, like in all honesty, it disappeared from my mind for years, you know, like a faded memory, nothing really significant, because it was, I guess in my mind, it was just two friends chopping it up.
Absolutely. You know,
there weren't like bullet points. Like it was just two good friends who were having conversations, and that could be any day of any year of any decade. And that was just another day. But what I found out later, you know, as in when I found the tweet, was that that one conversation had a deeper impact on my friend than I could have ever imagined.
Mm.
And it was like, wow, I had no idea that just being open and honest like that did that for somebody else. It kind of takes the selfish element out of it. You know, because back then, it was like, you know, like I said, this is my friend. We'll just have a conversation. So sure. I'm going to answer him as honest as I can. And whatever comes out of it is what comes out of it. But what I come to find out, just in learning where Drew has come,
sorry, guys.
Like, that was major for him.
Well, and I'll be honest. I do trace back some things to that conversation as being like a pivot point for me, like a data, like a pin in it, like in my journey, right? Because before that, I was like, it didn't matter, but I wasn't. The evolution was pretty darn slow for quite a while. And even I would say until maybe August 9th. So Mike Brown's death, I was pretty apathetic. I've admitted that before, that, I was very comfortable in my elite white male privilege.
Truthfully, Drew, I don't even think that's a fair thing to say. Like, I feel like America was comfortable. You like to put it and say you were comfortable, but honestly,
I use I statements.
I know, but I'm saying the country
was comfortable.
Was comfortable, and it had allowed itself to
fall asleep at the wheel.
Yeah, believe the hype or lack thereof, should I say? So it was a wake up call. Generally speaking, it was an awakening on a grand scale. So it wasn't just you, very white guy. It's not always about you, very white guy.
Easy now.
Just kidding. Okay, cool. So I think first of all, thank you both for taking my question so wonderfully.
Sorry, and I intruded so much.
That's okay.
Problem,
So I want to turn real quick, and then we're going to actually come back to you both. This will become full circle in a moment. But for International Women's Day, a bunch of amazing women made these videos called Dear Me. I'm actually going to do one this weekend with my sister, which is people were charged to give advice. Women were charged to give advice to their younger selves. Okay, so I'm going to play Cheska Lee's video, and I'm going to play one other one after.
Today, YouTube asked a bunch of YouTubers to answer the question, if you could go back in time and give yourself advice, what would you say? And I think the advice that I most needed when I was growing up and to this very day would have to be just be yourself and don't compare yourself to anyone else. I spent and wasted so much time trying to fit in with people that were nothing like me, listening to the same music that they listened to, wearing the same clothes that they did, hanging out with people that I just didn't really like that much, but I wanted them to like me and I wanted to be more like them. And it was just silly because I'm really cool the way that I am, and there's no reason to change yourself for someone else. And it's silly to compare who you are to other people because everyone is different, and that's what makes everyone so awesome. And I think so often we look at how successful someone else is or the great things that they're doing, and we think like, oh, I wish I could do those things, or I'll never be as good as that person. And it's a terrible way to think about yourself and the things that you want to accomplish in life, because you just never know what someone else is going through or what they had to go through to get to where they are. No one has it perfect. Everyone has challenges and struggles at one time or another. And when you see someone that's really successful, you're just seeing the results. You're not seeing all of the work and hardship and all the disappointment that happened before they got to where they are. So if you compare yourself to them, you're just doing yourself a disservice, because what you really should be doing is spending time and energy working on yourself and making yourself better so you can get where you want to go. So my advice, young Francesca, is instead of being jealous or feeling insecure or intimidated by people around you, look at the things that make them great and figure out how you can learn from them. And look at the things that have helped make them successful and see how you can do some of those things too. Or look at the mistakes that they've made so that you can avoid them and get to where you want to be in the time that you're supposed to be there. That's the other thing too, is I think most people, myself included, think like, I gotta hit these milestones at this time, and by this age, this has to happen. And it's totally unreasonable. Things happen the way that they're supposed to, and you achieve things when you're supposed to and when you deserve them. And so sometimes you think, this is what's supposed to happen for me, and this is what it's supposed to happen, and it's just, that's not what it is. And the right time will present itself, but the way that you get there is by doing the work and focusing on the goal and the work that it takes to get there, rather than focusing on what everybody else is doing and trying to make yourself like those people.
Okay, so that was Cheska Lee. And I'm going to play one more, which is actually from Akilah, whose story we told earlier about her Kiss Me, I'm Black t-shirt.
Dear me, from, I'm assuming, 10 years ago. So, dear 15-year-old me. Hey, girl. What's happening? How are you enjoying Kentucky? If I recall, it was fine. You weren't, like, really cool or a loser. You were just kind of, like, floating. But you skipped 2 grades, so you're about to graduate high school, which is crazy. Before you do that, I have some advice. First of all, we need to invent Facebook. I would have said MySpace, but MySpace is already there, and it's going to fizzle out very quickly. Facebook is where it's at, okay? What you need to do is get the hell out of Kentucky and go somewhere that has coding. I'm sure there's somebody in Kentucky who can teach you that, but you probably have better luck in, like, California or, like, somewhere with a real city. So go there. Learn how to code. Make friends with lots of dudes and nerds and girls and everybody who knows how to code. And build Facebook. How am I going to explain this to you? Facebook is a website where you can upload pictures of yourself and write things. It'll get even more interesting in the coming years because, like, cell phones are going to have these things called apps. And on apps, you can, you know, connect them to Facebook. You don't know what any of this means. Basically, what I'm saying is build Facebook. If you build Facebook, we will be billionaires, and I won't even have to be making this video. You're going to end up at Berea College. Spoiler alert. I think you're finding out, like, next week maybe that you got in. Spoiler. So you're going to go there. That'll be fun. Maybe put yourself out there a little bit more. Maybe when boys are like, hey, come over and watch a movie with me, and they really mean, hey, do you want to make out? Just go make out with them. You're not going to lose anything. None of these boys are diseased in Kentucky. When you're my age and you're using Tinder, which is an app that I cannot explain to you. Oh, my God. 10 years ago was so crazy. Live your dreams. Be a teen. Make out with boys. Your hair? Like, do you see how cool it is right now? Yeah. Maybe if you would, like, stop relaxing it now, like, instead of 4 years from your time, your hair would be, like, a mane by now. I mean, it's pretty cool, but, like, can you imagine having twice as much, if not more, hair? Like, you're a curly monster now. You would own the universe if you invent Facebook and have a giant mane. I feel like you weren't really going through much back then, so I don't have advice for that. 2007 is for everybody. You know, Britney Spears shaved her head. She's going to do that, so just be prepared. And I don't think you had a good 2007 either. It's just going to be real blunt. Everyone had a bad 2007 because it was right before the recession. Girl, don't take out all those loans. Like, don't buy clothes when you're in college. Don't spend your money on anything because you're not going to get a job immediately after college. Like, it's just not possible. All of your friends are going to be broke and jobless, and they're going to start calling you millennials and saying you moved in with your parents and you have a roommate named Mom because you didn't, you know, do what you could have done, or, like, all of that you could have done to not be a millennial and be born into the shitty recession. So what I'm saying is, you know what? Things are going to get real. You're going to get a black president. I know, crazy. And then the economy's going to go to Save your money, make your hair big, build apps, build Facebook. If you don't build Facebook, build Instagram. If you don't build Instagram, build Snapchat. Build something. Oh, and one last thing. So right now, you're watching me on a thing called YouTube, which becomes popular, I think, like, 6 months from where you are. Not super popular, which is good, because if you start making videos now, by the time you're my age, you can just rest on your laurels, make the same garbage video every week, and people miraculously still watch it. You'll probably have, like, 5 million subscribers. People will be like, I can't get enough of you. I've been watching you since I was 10. Yeah, all of your subscribers, for the most part, if you do this, what I'm telling you, are going to end up being tweens. You know, it's a way to go. Lots of people are living their dreams, making millions of dollars a year by just having been around since 2006. It's 2015, you know? We could have it all. Like, I think that covers it. Thank you for watching. I don't know.
So, that was Akilah. She's very funny. Avio, maybe we can get her on the show, Drew.
What?
Put a pin in that. We might be able to do it. I bet you. We'll see. If she doesn't already have a podcast, we might be able to get her. I told you Francesca Lee started one, right? With her husband. Her white husband.
No! Don't do... Don't... Cheska? Cheska.
They have, like, 9 or 10 episodes so far. I just have to say that.
Don't like it.
They probably have more followers than
I'm teasing. It's another... I'm sure they do. She's got, like, 50,000 people. Yeah, she writes for Is it like Upworthy or whatever?
Yeah, it is Upworthy. Anywho, shout out to you, Cheska Lee. Thanks for sharing, and also at Akila. I'll put those links on the show notes.
I'll give
it I'll turn the question to each of you now that we've had this walk down memory lane. If you had to give some advice to Ennis and Andy walking into the suite at Western Michigan University all those many years ago, I'll ask you each what advice you would have given to yourself. And we will start with you, Very White Guy.
At that point in my life, I was very concerned about what other people thought, and I put a lot of time, effort, and energy into, oh, what would this person think, and what would that person think? And I'm not saying that's like, you know, don't do that ever, like don't be disrespectful, like, you know, don't be like totally like thoughtless. But I would say, you know, learn to care less about, I guess maybe... I was concerned about popularity and just, you know, foolishness. I would say, you know, don't invest as much time in worrying about what other people think about you and about this or that. Just be you, be yourself, and be yourself and be happy and comfortable with who you are, and don't worry about what other people think. That's what I would say. So be yourself, be happy and comfortable with who you are, and don't worry about, and fuck the haters.
That's the overall thing? Yeah, fuck the haters. Yeah. Okay, got it. Okay, Ennis, how about you? What would you tell young Ennis walking onto Western Michigan's campus?
Looking at some skinny kids walking into the dorm room, I would say, hey, Ian, you're going to see some weird stuff. You're going to see some really strange stuff. Despite everything that you encounter, in spite of all the people that you're going to run into that are going to prove how messed up the world is, you need to follow your own heart. First and foremost, you need to follow your own heart. I'm a writer today. And what a lot of people don't know is that I was a writer back then. But I was ashamed to let that out. So I kind of suppressed it. I didn't do it very well. So I would say to that young kid, follow your heart no matter what. Believe the old man when he tells you, if you start following your heart right now, it's going to save you a lot of heartache. Oh, and one more thing. It hasn't happened yet, but I'm telling you, in January, coming up, 1992, don't take that first drink.
Don't take that
first drink. Trust the old man when he tells you. If you don't take that first drink then, you're really going to save yourself some heartache.
Wise sage. So,
yeah. Follow your heart and don't take that first drink.
Good
advice. I have to tell young in it.
Very good. Awesome. So fantastic. What about you,
Leslie? What would you...
I told you I'm doing it with my sister this weekend, so I'm not going to talk about what my dear me would be. Thank you very much. Well, that closes the Tale of Two Suite Mates portion of the show.
Before you close it out, I'll just say, Al, I'm sorry, buddy. And I apologize. I apparently was pretty oblivious to your being pissed. And I'll just say to this day, I think I'm a better person for it. And I hope to think that I've had some sort of, you know, I don't know, outward benefit for somebody or some sort of, you know, value to the Black Lives Matter movement. And
I think you'll find it hilarious where you are today. That's what I think. First, you have to be like, boom, and then I would have to explain it, and he'd be like, oh, yeah. And then I'd tell him how your life is, and he's like, no. Really? Really?
You probably won't remember it. It'll be like you. It'd be like, huh? Who? Yeah. What?
There is that possibility.
I'll have to scan a picture of me from back and then with my glasses and everything. You're like, oh, that idiot.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
That guy.
So we usually finish up the show, talk a little bit about some TV shows. Do you watch The Flash at all on the CW?
We should, you know, we're going, I don't say long, but if we're going long, give Ennis a...
Oh, yeah, Ennis, you can definitely bow out for the short bit at the end here. And we can just talk to you about where people can find you real quick.
It's up to you, whatever you want.
I do not watch The Flash. I don't watch a whole lot of TV at all, to tell you the truth. So I will bow out of this segment. But if you guys got a question for me, you know, I'm more than willing to...
Yeah, well, first tell everyone where they can find you, where they can find your music, your Twitter handle. They can check you out.
I think the easiest thing
for somebody who's looking for me would be to find me on my About Me page. That is www.about.me/InnisSmith. From there, you can find my Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. You can find my writing blog. You can find my music. Right now, I've got a book coming out at the end of this year.
Oh, my gosh.
What I did was I put the first two chapters up just to kind of generate, you know, some fan interest. And they've been getting a really good reviews from a lot of people. So if people will go to my writing blog, Writing with the Lord, you'll find those first two chapters for the Paraclete's Promise. Yeah, I encourage people to go there, check that out, and by all means, leave a comment. Find me on Facebook, on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm on the page now. We'll make sure to get that
link.
Yeah,
we'll have the link. All those links we'll have on the show notes as well. So, you know, just from me personally, thank you so much for coming on the show and taking the time out to speak with us. I really appreciate it. And also just as a wife and as a Black woman, I will say thank you very much for your early tutelage in creating my wonderful husband, because you really
did. I wouldn't call it that.
Well, it was a hand, whether you knew it or not. It was, you know, to him it was important, and you know, we're the sum of all the things that have come before us, and so this was one of the things in his equation. So thank you very much for that, and thanks for coming on the show, and I'm sure we'll have you back again soon, certainly. Yep. To talk about your book. We definitely want to have you on to talk about that.
Definitely.
Drew, did you have any other?
Yeah, well, I want to keep in dialogue. I know I'm and I say that I mean I really wanted to remain in dialogue, but I'm horrible. I'm really, like, I'm only on Twitter practically. I eschew Facebook, but I'll email you. We can email. That's a decent. I don't respond immediately, but I do like communicating by email, and just, I don't know, just keep talking, maybe on the phone or have you on the show another time. And particular about your journey, and particular with faith. I didn't talk today or with you about my background, but you know, I identify as a Unitarian Universalist, but then also maybe an agnostic leaning atheist. But so I do want to you know, speak to you more about your journey, you know,
we're going to have a good conversation, man.
I know, I'm sure. Well, and you know, you said when we connected, I said it was amazing, and you said it was God. And I can't lie. There's been, when I say I'm an agnostic-leaning atheist, we haven't gotten deep into it. And I don't know if we even talked about it on this show. And it's a very odd tangent, so I'll be really quick about it. But there's been instances in my life where it's like, wow, there was a, you know, whether you want to call it the, you know, power of love, light, you know, whatever you know, that which may be called God, there was some sort of, it felt like a force or something bigger than me in play, in motion, and powerfully so. I felt like to the core of my bone, things that are just undeniably. So it's hard for me to say, like, oh, I'm an atheist, because it's, you know, I've had personal experiences that are, you know, and I would put your and my connection, you know, it's hard to say, oh, that's just sort of, it's some sort of random coincidence, and oh, it doesn't mean this, doesn't mean that, you know, and you're married to a white woman, I'm married to a Black woman. It's powerful. It really is. So I want to talk to you more about it, and maybe not necessarily on the podcast, but, just, you know, as friends.
Most definitely. You got my number, and you got my Twitter, and more importantly, you guys are moving back to Michigan.
We are.
So,
we can take this to real life.
Road trip. So, yeah, most definitely. I'm expecting you both to keep in contact from this point on.
Absolutely.
And, sure. You know, for me, Drew, it's easy for me to recognize when God works in my life. So the mere fact that I learned so much about you today, about how you are as an adult man, it's just proof that God is working in both of our lives right now. So we will. We'll have a talk. We'll have a very good conversation about our beliefs and, you know, our background.
Right on. I'd enjoy that. It would be Leslie called it TD, the dialogue. It would be like the dialogue 2.0. the dialogue God 0.0.
Dialogue. Yep, it'll be good. It definitely will. I enjoyed myself. I'm glad you guys invited me on.
Well, fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you for giving your time. We really, really appreciate it. And and what is your say your family's name? What's your wife and your kids' names?
I am married for, it'll be 14 years this coming August.
What?
Misty Dawn Smith. Okay. Our oldest son is Tomas Guadalupe Ramirez III. Our oldest son together is Nathaniel. He's 18. Our oldest daughter is Dominique. She is 17. Our youngest daughter, Jordan, 12. And our youngest son, Isaiah, is 9. So we got our hands full.
You do.
Definitely have our hands.
Well, thank you for saying the names, and we appreciate it. And we'll have to get together. Like you said, you're in Michigan. We're only about 3 hours away, and we'll know. I think we're shooting sometime middle of this year, but we'll definitely be in touch well before that.
Definitely.
And thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. All right. Well, we'll send you the link of the show once it's ready, of course. And like I said, you guys can follow Ennis on Twitter at Ennis_C_Smith. And we will have all the links to all of his to his music and also to his blog and everything on the show notes. So thanks so much, Ennis.
Thanks, dude.
All right.
All right.
See you.
Have a good night. Bye.
Bye. Is he still on? Or is he off?
There he goes.
Okay.
There he goes.
He doesn't know how I roll. I'm going to send like 12 packages of those powdered donuts.
Yeah, it's bad. This is going to be bad for Ennis.
There's going to be like a powdered donut of the month kind of cover or something. I'll figure it out. I'll just start
sending like donut like t-shirts, donut socks, a donut tie. It's going to be funny. So I did want to run through just a couple things. One, the Flash this week.
Dude.
Are you kidding me with that?
For real? So listen, I'm away on business and I don't have the DVR, but I'm in the hotel and I'm watching it and you are recording FRN and I'm texting you like, are you fucking kidding me with this show? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Like I was literally like geeking out. Like I love the Flash.
Man,
I think it's
Cisco's
good.
Cisco's crying. Oh, died. I was like, don't cry, Cisco.
When he's like, I kept it from everybody and including you and the tears. Oh.
When he said, I can help you.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. So freaking good. And then
in the same episode, you get fucking
Ivy.
Everything.
Anyways, if y'all aren't watching The Flash, you're missing out. Get on it. CW. The season is not over, so you could binge watch it like this weekend and catch up and watch the last couple episodes of the season.
It's been on point.
I believe it's already been renewed, but I'm sure there will be. It's just been so, so good.
The special effects for a CW show.
And for a freshman
amazing.
Season out, they're not playing. They just threw everything at the wall. The other thing we have to just wrap up, I wouldn't even say wrap up. I have a feeling we'll be talking about this for quite some time, which is the Robert Durst life and death. So I want to play Jarecki's interview. He did one interview the morning after the show ran, which was it was on CBS This Morning, which nobody watches, which is interesting.
Most rated show.
It's like, I don't know anybody that watches it. I've never seen an interview, a single episode of it.
A real-life dramatic ending this morning to a documentary.
I'm going to pause here just for a second just to mention that I when I watched this the first time, I was like, oh, that's what their set looks like?
That's what I was going to say.
Like, I literally had no, I didn't even know who the hosts were. I'm like, Gayle King's on this thing? When did that happen? I had no idea.
I saw a clip with her the other day. I'm like, what is this? It's a morning show? She's on the morning show?
Yeah.
Oh.
So we'll just play a bit of this. I'm going to actually get through the intro part because people probably know about that by now. All right.
The murder of his friend, Susan Berman.
HBO aired the finale of The Jinx last night. Dirk spoke about Berman's death, the disappearance of his first wife, and the killing of his neighbor back in 2001. Durst was still wearing a microphone when he went to use the bathroom after the interview.
I'm having difficulty with the question.
The Jinx director, Andrew Jarecki, joins us now at the table. Andrew, good to see you. I watched it last night with my mouth open, and even though the words were on the screen, I had to rewind it to hear What exactly am I hearing? So when did you all realize you had that recording, and when did you take it to the authorities?
Well, we actually interviewed Bob Durst two times. The first time was for about 3 days back in 2010, and we were surprised that he made a whole bunch of admissions and said things that were kind of shocking. Mm-hmm. And we thought we would go back to him again at some point. And then we went back to him again a couple of years later to show him this new evidence that we had discovered. And we thought we were done at the end of the interview. And he reacted in a strong way to the material that we showed him. And then he got up and said goodbye. And we thought that was the end. But his microphone kept recording. We always leave the microphone on him. He knows that. And he went to the bathroom while it was recording. And it wasn't until months later that we had an editor listening to material that we had just sort of left behind, thinking, well, now we've got to listen to everything we've got. We're about to finish the series. And we discovered that we had this shocking piece of audio.
The New York Times said 2 years. You said it was months later when you
many
found
months.
It.
I mean, it was obviously for us a shock because it was many months since we had sat down with him. And then after sitting down with him, we thought, well, we've got the sort of revelation, which is he was unable to determine which of the two handwritings that we were showing him was his own. In fact, we think both of them were his own. And then after that, he got up, and it was not until many months later that we actually, you know, realized that the more interesting revelation might have been the secret revelation.
Is this a guy who walked around all the time talking to himself?
He does, and he does even in the series. There are moments when he's walking past his brother's house on the west side of Manhattan, and he's just talking openly. He says, "Ridiculous! It's just ridiculous!" You know,
even though there's no one with him,
I mean, he says actually in his testimony in Galveston back when he was originally tried for murder of his neighbor. He says quite openly that for long periods in his life, he spoke openly to himself in groups of people, and that he would upset people. People would say, "Are you talking to me?" Because he said, "I would have long conversations with myself perfectly out loud, and people would think I was talking to them, and they'd be upset to hear that."
Yeah, your family didn't notice that?
So he's aware of that.
So
it's clear to you he killed them all.
I think that's certainly what he says, and I have no reason to believe that that's not the case. What's amazing to me is that he came to us knowing what he knew about his life. We didn't know that, right? All we could do was assume that some bad things had happened. We weren't exactly sure what. And then he voluntarily called me around the time that my film was coming out and said, "I've heard about this movie. I'd like to see it." And then he volunteered to come and sit for an interview.
So against
the advice of his attorney, who is now suggesting, Andrew, that you were in coordination with the authorities, that he's arrested on Saturday and your big finale is on Sunday, that it was all sort of a pre-plan between you and the authorities.
Well, the truth is that we hoped that Robert Durst would be arrested as soon as possible. And we were sort of amazed ourselves that he hadn't been arrested for so long. But the authorities were never communicating with us other than in their normal cordial way. They were going through their investigation.
Did you give that to the authorities before the finale yesterday?
Long
that
before.
Audio?
I mean, they've had the audio. Yeah. They've had that audio for many months.
What is the family saying?
His family?
I'm going to pause here. I'm actually going to just stop it here. I mean, I wanted to get to those couple of questions because the one question you had yourself thinking that, as you always
do. No, but we discussed it.
That, you know, that they were in cahoots and this was
I wasn't cahoots. It wasn't that. It was that it was they were grateful. And as a part of their gratitude, they're like, "Well, we'll arrest him the day before." But really, I think the more logical conclusion is all they had was this audio. That's not, they missed hanging a fucking body he admitted to chopping up into pieces. He couldn't get jail time for that. So I can understand them wanting to like really get their ducks in a row. And what do? He needs much time. And you start following him and you follow him and follow him and follow him and you take as much time, but you can't let him watch the show because then he's going to fucking flee. So you arrest him, you know, the day before. Makes
well,
sense.
Well, since that interview that we just aired, Andrew Jarecki has done no other interviews, and he and producing partner Mark Smerling released the following statement: "Given that we are likely to be called as witnesses in any case law enforcement may decide to bring against Robert Durst, it is not appropriate for us to comment further on these pending matters. We can confirm that evidence, including the envelope and the washroom recording, was turned over to the authorities months ago." So that will probably be the last we hear from Andrew Jarecki on this matter for quite some time. In addition,
you hear what he got arrested with? Is that what you're going to go into?
In addition, you want to go ahead and talk about that?
Yeah, he got busted. They're now giving like more information about his arrest, and I think it was New Orleans, a port city we've mentioned. He got busted with a full face latex latex or rubber mask to like deceive his appearance in a significant manner.
Not just deceive your appearance, but also to deceive
face detection, face scanning.
Recognition, absolutely. Scanning. Yeah.
That's a specific purpose.
Specifically.
And I forget how much cash it was, but they said, I think it was like over $40,000. But they said, and this is again indicative of the fact that they were tailing him for a significant period of time, he had withdrawn. First of all, he's worth over 100 mil. Yep. He'd withdrawn $9,000, which is just 1,000 shy of, I guess, 10,000, which triggers some sort of notification to the federal authorities for tax purposes. Withdrew $9,000 daily since October.
Yeah, he had $42,000 in cash on him when they caught him, but the money was in $100 bills parceled out into various small envelopes. They believed that he was going to use the envelopes to send the money to the place where he was fleeing to. They even found a UPS tracking number in the hotel, which Durst told them was so he could ship a large sum of cash. They say that, like you said, he's worth $100 million, and he was in the process of planning to ship a lot more than $42,000 because of what you just said, which was that totals $315,000 he had withdrawn over 35 consecutive days, $9,000 each day, Christ. Which, as you know, is the maximum without it triggering a FDIC notice. He also had a 38 Smith & Wesson with one spent shell casing and four live rounds. It's unclear where the gun was fired. And they found three books in his Houston apartment, two copies of the same book, A Deadly Secret, The Strange Disappearance of Kathy Durst, one in paperback and one in hard copy.
What? So, no way. Yeah.
That dude gets
so psychopathic behavior.
And creepier.
Dave Biro had clippings creepier. Of the murders.
He did.
They can't help themselves.
Listen, I watched that thing about Dave Biro.
No, you did the ID Discovery? You did it? You watched it without me? Come on. Why'd you do that?
You can watch it. I'll watch it again. Your recollections of this situation are portrayed very differently than what the TV show says.
Oh, so in what regard?
Well, let's watch it. We'll talk about it on the show.
Okay.
So you want to do some shout outs?
What was the shout out? I don't remember.
We're talking about the Flash. You didn't have to do any shout outs. I saw some names here and I thought they were.
Oh, no, that was.
I was
typing names of Anna's and his wife and his kids.
You can just email him and ask him that, anyways. So I think that brings us to the end of the show. Did you got anything else to share?
No, just I'm glad to be back home, but now you're taking off.
I am going to the Amnesty International General Assembly this weekend.
A little bit too late to get the pottery, so it's going to have to be Sunday. We have to figure a way out to do it.
Yeah, or you could just go now. So coming up on the interracial, John, next Wednesday we will have the hilarious Ijeoma Olowu on the show. Very exciting. It's a good week next week, man. And then Saturday, the 28th, have our podcast sister and brother from the North, Sherasaurus.
Chonilla.
From shonilla.com.
Motherfucking
Eastern time. So we're going to be sitting down with them. And actually, Charlotte's coming on FRN next week as well. Really? And then the following week, one Black Rob will be joining us for a little tete-a-tete.
Maybe Clove wants to do a podcast with me. Me and Clove can do a podcast.
Yeah, because he's got...
all-time
three
world.
Kids, yeah. A full-time job, a whole podcast network, and he's got time to just, you know, hang out with you on a regular basis.
No, I guess what I say, we should flip up the podcast wife swap we did.
Yeah.
Instead of wife swap, we could do chicks and dicks.
Yeah, you could do that.
And me and Clove. Although, I don't know, would that be a good podcast, me and Clove?
I don't know. Two white dudes talking about shit? Sounds like America to me. Although, he's not from America, so...
What's wrong with two white dudes? Come on.
What's wrong with two white dudes?
You can't. I can't just be.
Do I really need to go into that? What's wrong with two white dudes?
I feel like all I'm
pull
doing,
up a chair.
I feel like all I'm doing is a white guy's apology.
Let me get something
time.
To drink and settle
I'm
in
sorry,
to
I'm
answer
white.
That question.
I'm sorry.
What's wrong with two white guys? Angry black lady today on, or actually yesterday on Twitter Prime, went on a epic rant about white dude Twitter.
Oh, no.
Always feeling the need to let their opinion be known.
Sure.
I'm
just asking a question.
I just tweeted. I don't even want to talk about it, but I tweeted about the gentleman, Otis Bird, who was found hanging in Mississippi. And CNN's story about him has a mugshot up as his picture.
I know.
So I tweeted out at CNN, why do you have a mugshot up of Otis Bird, who was just found killed? That's, you know, crazy. It's just ridiculous. And I'd put hashtag Black Lives Matter. This fucking white dude has to write back to me. Not judging here, but maybe they used a mugshot because that was all they could get. Insensitive? Maybe. Really, bitch? What did I say back? I said, are you suggesting no other photos of this man exist? Because otherwise your explanation sounds ridiculous. Like, what the fuck is he talking about right now? That's all they could get their hands on. Because, you know, there isn't Google or Facebook, and they're not, you know, a large news organization that can get any information they want or publish a goddamn article without a photo till you get one that's not this dead man's mugshot. Man, fuck you. At RBW424, Bruce Winterburn, fuck you. You can find the Interracial John on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. Or on our website, interracialjohn.com. We're also on iTunes, Stitcher, iTunes, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that good stuff at Interracial John. You can find me on Twitter at Leslie Mack. That's M-A-C. And you can find that dude at Very White Guy.
You were talking about white Twitter. I said...
white dude Twitter.
White dude Twitter. That I'm right. Prove me wrong is a privileged white dude's motto on Twitter. Just like fucking.
That is, yeah.
Just that's the stance every time. I'm right. Prove me wrong.
That's their facts. Basic.
Prove me wrong. Facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty much.
Pretty much.
All right. I think that's all we got for tonight.
That's it. All right.
Yep.
Good night, everybody.
High five.